Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. So nice to be with you, Kevin. How are you, my friend?
Good. I got over the schmutz. I'm feeling a lot better. I listened to last week's podcast. I never do. And I listened and I sounded like hell. So thank you for enduring my congested nasally drone. That was horrible.
Yeah, the whole time when you were talking, I was on mute and I was just telling myself, oh, this guy's voice is so annoying. I wish he'd just shut up. And
well, no, you could like hear the phlegm and boogers and stuff. It was really gross. So this year or this week, I promise a much more cleaner resonance.
Yeah, you sound up to snuff this week.
A little better, yes. Certainly a little better.
Before we get into our stories, I'm very excited to announce that my son said dad-da for the first time yesterday morning.
Nice.
It's a thrilling experience. And right after he did that, he headbutted me right in the left eye socket. So that was an interesting.
Oh, that's nice.
Interesting contrast. But I figured I'd share that with everyone. So my face hurts a little today, but I'm happy to be here nonetheless.
Do you have one of those baby books that says like first time you said dada and you write it in there and then first headbutt?
Yeah. Put that kind I don't of have thing. It written down. Everything's in my head. I have all of these key moments in his life thus far saved, but maybe I should write them down just in case I start forgetting things or I think I'm an orange tree or something when I'm older, you know, because who knows what will happen in my golden years.
In your greening years.
Yeah. All right, we better stop or I'm going to start making puns about citrus greening disease and all. Anyways, okay, let's get into our stories. So first up, unraveling the mystery of who gets lung cancer and why. Next, how fetal facial scans can help identify serious diseases early. And finally, is conventional, quote, industrialized agriculture destroying biodiversity or saving it? Very, very intriguing questions. Kevin, what are we talking about here? Lung cancer.
Well, this is really just an extension of one we covered last week, because the same article was taken apart by somebody else, and this one was discussed by our friend Jeffrey Cabot. And it just was a slightly different take with some other details that I thought would be good to add to our composite of what we already covered. And so the basic idea of the study was they looked at the genetic changes that were happening inside the in a specific cell type in the bronchi. And when you did that, you're able to essentially catalog the changes that were occurring because of smoking or because of other factors. Let's just put it that way. And the big deal is that, you know, we mentioned last week, lung cancer is a very prevalent cancer worldwide. And it's a lot of cases, like 2 million cases a year. It's quite a few. And it's also, they always mention that this is one that most of the cases are preventable. But at the same time, there are still people who are heavy smokers who never get the disease. So what's the story? And we discussed last week that a lot of this seems to be accumulation of mutations that are occurring inside DNA repair genes. And folks who smoke a lot seem to have protection because for some reason they don't accumulate those changes, some sort of better genetic surveillance, that whole thing. This article by Dr. Cabot started to look at a couple other issues, and that was mostly what was happening in China, because there are other issues that when you start breaking it down by sex and then smoking versus non-smoking in China, you see some other trends that pop out. And I just thought that we'd mention these. In China, you see lung cancer rates are increasing for both sexes. And it's not a big surprise. I think in the cities, when I spent a lot of time in China, a lot of heavy smokers there and a lot of men smoking, especially. I've had Chinese visitors come to my lab who've had a really hard time because of the very strict no smoking campus. The one guy would smoke in the fume hood with his and blow his smoke up the fume hood. you know, that's actually a guy I know in UCLA does that. So you don't want to always have to go all the way outside to go, you know, to have a cancer dart, you know? So to enjoy a coffin nail, whatever else they call them. Anyway, so what they've really shown is that there's still a huge percentage that were never smokers that are getting lung cancer, and this is happening in China, and that you can see differences in the type of tumors that you have, that they have. And basically what it boils down to is that they have one set of mutations that are very clearly linked to cancer and another set which appear to be happening from environmental drivers, but the two data sets are a little bit different. So they have some that they understand well what's happening, but they don't know how, and another set that they show is contributing, but they're not exactly pinpointing the changes that are occurring. And so as one person on Twitter put it, when I posted this article, the article says in the beginning, who gets cancer and why? And he says, well, according to the article, we still don't exactly know. So that was the major, major thing I wanted to touch on today.
I love Jeffrey's writing because he's very systematic and matter of fact. There's not a lot of rhetorical flourish, but it's just the straight dope. Here's what we know. And in this particular case, I love that he, in so many words, he dismisses like 50 years worth of epidemiological research as more or less unsubstantiated. And this has to do with these environmental risk factors that have been suspected of causing lung cancer. So passive smoking, asbestos exposure, some other environmental factors that may contribute. But he linked to a big meta-analysis of all this data. And he just said, you know, the evidence for these associations is weak. On to the next. I don't know why I love that. I think there's a certain bravery in it. Like, he's just going to tell you what the evidence says. He doesn't care if it's unpopular. I just really admire that in a scientist of his caliber. But in any event, he sets up that aspect of the story, and then he goes on to talk about these differing genetic influences, or maybe genetic signatures, that seem to separate lung cancer in smokers and non-smokers. So can we dive a little bit more into that? Because I think this is your expertise in a lot of ways.
Well, there's a couple of genetic factors, and we touched on this a little bit last time, but the folks who seem to have a sensitivity to changes that are occurring through the epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase. So these are membrane-bound receptors that modulate cellular behavior in response to an external ligand. So what this means is some sort of factor comes along, binds on, and causes changes in the molecule. And they say it's a tyrosine kinase. It means that it's phosphorylated on specific residues of the protein, which causes a change in its signaling state. So maybe the easy way to think about this is that this is like the antenna on the outside of the cell, that when it gets activated, stuff happens downstream. And these are typically targets for specific chemotherapy regimens, and that some of the cancers that happen because of smoking seem to be refractory to these types of treatments. Other ones respond well to those treatments. It depends upon the different types of cancers, because they're not, you know, cancer is not one flavor. In lung cancer, you have adenocarcinomas versus other squamous cell carcinomas. So two different flavors of cancers that happen typically in the lung. And they did start to see this when you looked epidemiologically, and I can't remember the details of the paper at this point. It seemed like the Asian women tended to develop the adenocarcinomas, which is a peripheral lung disease. You'd start to get this in different parts of the lung versus the squamous cell, which was much more a small cell lung cancer in the bronchi. So it was a little different etiology of the disease. So I think that's the way that those kinds of things shake out.
You just mentioned it, but can you talk a little bit more about the fact that different patients responded differently to the same treatments that they were receiving? And I don't remember if that clued them into the possibility that they were looking at things that had, you know, there was something different going on under the hood, so to speak, in these contrasting cases, or if they found those genetic details first, and then that pointed them to the fact that they respond differently to treatments. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's a chicken or the egg thing there that I'm not too sure about. But I know that you can flush out, you can separate different types of cancers based upon their resistance to specific treatments. And there may be some, say, first-line treatments that are attempted in specific types of lung cancers that they can tell if it's refractory to that or not. And that, my guess is that this is just another way in which they're able to tell which flavor of lung cancer they're talking about.
I got it. I would just encourage everyone to read this article because it's sort of a real-time summary of what people are looking into in this field. Because a lot of the stuff we talk about, it's established science. You know, something like the safety of genetically engineered crops or the safety of glyphosate or something like that. There's 3,000 studies or in something in that ballpark looking at those questions, and they almost all agree in varying degrees on the conclusion. But with something like this, he's very honest in saying, you know, we just don't know. We've been looking at it for 50 years and we're still trying to figure it out. So I think it's cool that he's acknowledging that for a general audience, but it also gives you a front row seat into how this is done. And, you know, he makes some analogy, but he says something to the effect of, you know, we uncover one clue and then that points us in one direction and it's a dead end. Okay, well, then we turn to the right and then we go in this direction. So maybe you can talk a little more generally about that, because I think that's probably relevant to any kind of scientific investigation.
Well, what I think is it really illuminates is the heterogeneity of what they're calling cancer. So cancer not being one thing, but a whole series of disorders in abnormal cell growth and proliferation. And so what you're looking at here is essentially that it occurs sometimes for very defined reasons, mutations that we can understand and categorize, which their causal agents are sometimes known. Their environmental influences are sometimes known, such as we talked about last week with specific mutations in tumor suppressor genes or the genes that induce them. But other ones are not so cut and dry. And I think it just is because a lot of reasons to this. Tumors, as they exist, they evolve and they, you know, in real time. So they're changing constantly. And that's one of their hallmarks. They're sloppy in their replication. And so they're constantly changing, which can make them even more challenging to treat. So that's all these overlays of the constantly changing tumors, the heterogeneity between individuals within tumors and their causal mutations, the predispositions different people have towards different cancers. All those things come to the fore when you're trying to think through these questions about, you know, nailing down one causal one factor. And I think that's why this is just such a cloudy subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me read this quote. This is towards the end of the story, but I think it appropriately sums up what we know or maybe what we don't know at this point. So Dr. Cabot writes, in the first case, smokers with lung cancer, a potent carcinogen has been identified, but the precise way in which it causes cancer is unclear. In the second instance, a driver mutation which leads to cancer has been identified in a large proportion of cases, but evidence for environmental triggers is either weak or lacking. So I think that just sort of sums up the collective shoulder shrug that epidemiology has to give. Like, no, we don't know, because they just don't know yet. People are looking into it, but I think that's pretty fascinating, Kevin.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think, and I agree with that. I think that, you know, just in this, my understanding of this field may be a little antiquated, but it seemed as though there were some pretty specific mutations that seem to be frequent or have a higher frequency among smokers in specific genes. So there was some sort of direct causal assertion, because these were all like tumor suppression genes, things like that, like P53, as we mentioned. But you know, I'll leave it to the cancer epidemiologist to trust what he's saying for a little more of an update. So there we go.
Imagine that, leaving it to the expert to talk about his expertise. What a crazy concept in this world we live in. Okay. Fetal facial scans, Kevin, and identifying diseases early in life. Talk about this.
Yeah, this is kind of neat. I never knew this before. It turns out that this is from Sudhakar Reddy in Times of India. And I was perusing it the other day in my dentist's office. and there's been a lot of interest in how can you make predictions from a fetus or, you know, pre-birth to talk about specific problems that may exist. And the couple of reasons for that is that, you know, if there's catastrophic changes that can really threaten the life of the mother, you know, there, it used to be that you could abort, you know, the fetus. Not sure where that is at this point. But there also were other reasons that if you knew of problems ahead of time, some of them could be corrected immediately upon birth. And then now there's even cases of fetal surgery. So going in and patching up some stuff before the baby's even delivered. And there's a lot of things that you could learn, like hydrocephaly, you know, like lack of a developing brain or a poorly developed brain, cleft palates. There's a number of cardiac problems you can find with a high-res ultrasound, ventricular septal defects. So like these, as a fetus, blood is flowing between the left and right ventricles because you're not using lungs. And so you're not breathing. So why pump blood through the lungs? So you just kind of go directly between the two chambers, and that sinus, or that septal area heals immediately before birth. So a lot of fun things that you can learn from looking at a fetus, amniocentesis. You can learn a lot from the amniotic fluid about, certain enzymes are signatures of spinal defects. You pick up acetylcholine esterase, which is a neurotransmitter associated enzyme. You can sometimes take guesses about problems with neural tube development, that kind of thing. Anyway, so what else can we learn from looking carefully at an ultrasound? And it turns out that scientists in India have started to identify specific traits or specific defects that you can almost associate well with specific facial features. So you can look at a fetus's face and start to take guesses about potential problems that it's having. And they, you know, mentioned a couple things. They mentioned, you know, extra fingers, and that they correlated with extra fingers. And gosh, what was the other one? There were just some things that were showing up in problematic morphology, and that you would see some sort of signatures in the face first, and that may be a good tip off to other morphological problems that the baby may have.
So I read this paper as best I could. It's pretty technical in places, but when I first read this, I thought it was just incidental, that there was just some sort of association between these morphological issues and then some genetic disorder. But if I'm reading this correctly, they're basically saying babies that have these conditions, they have these phenotypic issues because they have the diseases. So these actually might be like indicators of a condition. Do I have that basically correct?
Well, it's one of two things, right? So there are causal mutations, which could have multiple phenotypes. So a change in genetics that would, say, cause you to have poor kidney development, at the same time, some sort of very conspicuous defect of the orbital socket, like just the way that looks, you know, around the eye. Those things may be caused by a defect in the same issue during development. And you relate them back. Other things are just associations. And when you say associations, it means that if there's a problem in one gene and that problem is in kind of the whole genetic neighborhood, maybe some sort of epigenetic control, something like, you know, who knows, methylation status or other status of the DNA, chemical modification of DNA, let's put it that way, that affects the entire genetic neighborhood, you may see effects on two different genes affecting two different processes, but they always happen together. So that's the big difference. It's the difference between associations and causation.
That's interesting. Now, these are mostly Mendelian disorders they're talking about. So I think these only involve single genes, right?
Yeah. So they would be inherited as typically single recessive, Mendelian recessive traits.
Okay. Okay. Very interesting. So the study was pretty small. I think it was like 102 total cases that they're talking about. So this has to be replicated on a much larger scale, right? Is that, we talked about this last week too, how it was a really small study with the smokers who never got lung cancer. So you need many, many more people to sort of suss out a statistically significant trend, right?
Yeah. Well, this is what bothered me about the paper and why I, you know, take this kind of thing with a grain of salt and say, really cool phenomenon. I hope it's real. You know, and that's kind of how I want folks to think about this. They were talking that they mentioned they examined 102 dead fetuses, so ones that didn't make it to term for one reason or another. And then they were looking at associations between their ultrasounds and then specific defects that they found. And the defects were only, you know, they were looking at very small, like they would say in 3%. Well, that would be, what, 3 out of 102? You know, right. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of odd statistics reported in this news article. And I just think that, you know, the phenomenology is an interesting one. Can we learn a lot more from an ultrasound than the real conspicuous stuff like that we usually screen for in an ultrasound?
Yeah, I think it was less than half the cases. It was something like 44%.
Yeah.
So it's just a teeny tiny study, really. So I mean, I understand why the media would want to cover this, but it seems like it's very, very preliminary in terms of the reliability that this might have.
Well, yeah, all this is saying is this is something that we have a hunch is going to work, and now we'll look at it with more depth. And I think that as, you know, biometrics improve and this ability to take an image of a fetal face and pump it through a biometric pipeline and say, all right, distance between the pupils, distance between the nostrils, where they were in week 11 versus week 30, you know, to go, or is that right? Week 30? Is that, they go that long? Yeah, I guess they do. You know, where you look at the different stages of fetal development, which I've been studying a lot lately. Where is where you're seeing specific traits come up, and then what is associated once that baby's born? And when we see different defects that are happening upon birth, are there things that we could have flagged before birth?
What I wonder is if this will just become superfluous as our knowledge of genetics improves, because like with like pre-implantation genetic testing, for example, we're still a long way off for a lot of conditions. Don't get me wrong. But as that technology improves and you can look at particular mutations, even before a pregnancy starts, I wonder if this sort of thing will just be, it'll be old hat at some point. Like before it's able to develop into a useful method, we might not need it anymore. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. I mean, okay. You can imagine that DNA sequencing and that kind of thing are going to be much cheaper and faster than having to go in for an ultrasound. Probably there already. The thing is about this is, you know, if you talk to most genetic counselors, and I had a wonderful one on Talking Biotech a while back, she was fantastic. She was saying that modern genetic counseling, you don't even bother to look at the baby. You look at the two parents before they even try to get it on. And you know, can make predictions on, from those two parents' genotypes, whether or not they should be reproducing and things that they may consider in terms of probabilities of problems. And then if those things exist, then you can screen the fetus and have a very targeted look at potential problems. So genetic counseling is a really smoking hot field these days. And if you're into genomics and you're into thinking about like risk factors and how you may advise people and statistics and all that good stuff, get into genetic counseling, because from my understanding, she was fantastic. And she really gave a very very optimistic sense of the job market in genetic counseling. So good stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating, but it also is reassuring in a lot of ways. There was, I don't know if we talked about this on the show, Kevin, but there was a study just recently where they looked at, it was dysfunctional activity of a particular enzyme in babies that had died of SIDS. And the study's super preliminary, but I believe they could look at this during the pregnancy and they could say, oh, well, this might be a risk factor for SIDS. And so based on this, assuming that the results pan out, you can develop interventions or you can develop treatments that you could target particular children with because they might have an elevated risk of SIDS. And right now, the only way to diagnose it is after the baby dies, sadly. So it's these kind of things that are really, really exciting to me because, I mean, you could literally save someone's life and, you know, prevent a tragedy in a family. So this is really cool.
Yeah, it's the thing that makes me happy about these modern technologies is if you can start to have predictive power to even guess about, you know, these rare events, it gives you the heads up that you may want to anticipate them. And you're seeing this especially in different certain diseases, things like Huntington's disease and other diseases which are kind of rare that you can detect very specific genetic variants which have a high correlation or high association, high heritability, and effect on the disease, you know, in the person. So it allows you to take the right precautions and monitor the right stuff. Some people don't want to know, but I'll tell you what, I think, you know, more and more people are saying, I really want to know my potential predispositions so I can control what I can control. And I think that's really great.
100%. If there's something you can do about it, you know, I could understand someone saying, well, if there's literally nothing I can do about this, then, you know, all you're going to do is just give me something to worry about. So maybe I can understand that. But if it's something where there's a possible intervention on the horizon, or maybe there's a drug or I don't know, you know what I'm saying? In any case, all right, Kevin. So the hippies are still wrong about conventional agriculture.
Yeah, the hippies are still wrong. Yeah, but Dr. Steve Sargent isn't. Yeah, no. So one of the big things we always hear about is you know, that industrialized farming, you know, the factory farm, destroying biodiversity. And this is something that drives me a little nuts because I think we have been, and I'm kind of speaking from within the article by speaking larger about it here, we live in such a cool time where people have been collecting more seeds, been cataloging more seeds, making more unusual varieties available through the internet. I mean, I have a whole stupid apple experiment that came up from material I was able to accumulate just because I was able to find losers around the South who had a weird tree. And so there's a lot of things that these days allow us to expand diversity, and especially when we start looking at plant breeding, that really the bottleneck in biodiversity is well behind us at this point. And I think that's really the point that Dr. Savage makes, that between and he talks about different ways that we would go forward in preserving biodiversity. And it's a number of different factors that he talks about, but it's everything from just saving seeds and, you know, making sure we're cataloging our diversity, and other issues as well. Why is diversity important? Well, I think to me as a plant biologist and a plant sort of breeder, there is a lot of great genetic variation that plants have that allow them to cope with disease, environmental stress, all those good things. But the part that you want, the desirable fruit or vegetable part, is not of commercial quality. So we have these plants that have great genetics that can solve a problem, but you can't get those genetics into the backgrounds that have decent quality for consumer quality traits. So how do you do that? Well, it takes years and years of breeding or genetic engineering, but you have to have the original resource. And as plants go extinct, as we lose different lines, all that stuff kind of starts to go away. How do you ensure you have it? And so that's where, you know, Sargent Savage talks about the idea of saving seeds and gene banks, making sure that we're able to protect and preserve that stuff and understand and make the information about these genes available through databases. And so he's got a lot of different ideas that he's presented here. And I think he also agrees the days of limited diversity are probably behind us.
There's so many cool examples in the story, but what came to mind as I was reading it, two things really. The first is that this is a real practical evidence-based approach to solving a problem. And I don't think you get a lot of that, especially when people start talking about climate change. You know, we only have 10 years or 50 years, or, you know, New York City is going to be underwater in 2018. It's all of the coverage. It's always tinged with the end is nigh. And, you know, I can appreciate why people do that sometimes, because you're trying to emphasize how serious of a problem it is. But there's not a lot of solutions. You know, the solution is have fewer kids, or you can't drive a car anymore. But I think with this, you have a very good scientist in Dr. Savage outlining the sort of things that are being studied and that are being advanced in the field right now. It's so cool. It really reminds me of why I got so interested in biotechnology initially. But then it also underscores, and this is an old point, you know, sometimes I hate to bring it up, but the anti-GMO movement is just so off base. And you see in this story the damage that they do, because they really hold up really important work. And there's no reason behind it. Because what I get out of the story is that no matter what breeding technique you use, or it's all gene shuffling, you're just moving genetics around, even with traditional breeding, maybe especially with traditional breeding, because there's just thousands upon thousands of mutations that occur that you can't control or predict or anything, you know? So it brings home those two points to me. But I wanted to ask you about some of these specific examples. And the first one is, he talks about using gene editing to edit the DNA of a commercial crop by comparing it to a homologous gene in a wild relative of that plant. So can you talk a little bit about that? That's just so cool to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of this, actually. And maybe a really good example from grasses, from barley. One of the big problems in grasses like wheat and barley in the production is things like powdery mildew. And groups identified genes that in types of barley that never get it. You never get powdery mildew. And it turns out it's a mutation in a gene that is required for the pathogen to establish. Let's just leave it at that. If you mutate that gene, the pathogen can't shake hands with the plant and establish its infection. Wheat does not have this mutation. So you can go look at all the wheats in the world and you don't see that mutation, but it does have that same gene. So in other words, you have the mutant form of the gene confers resistance. Wheat doesn't have it. Barley does. You can't cross barley and wheat to get this gene in there. So what you can do is create the same mutation in wheat, and they did it, and it works. So you're able to infer from the function of a gene variant in one line, you're able to do this in a completely different species and be able to get the same outcome. And that's the real big power of gene editing. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Because like technically it's difficult to understand what they're doing, but logically it makes sense. You can just, so they're like shaving off the edges of this one gene to make it look like this other gene, and then it duplicates the function. And that's incredible that we have the power to do that. I just find that fascinating. There was another point he made about wine grapes that was funny. He calls wine grapes the original, quote, Frankenfood, complete with scars and all. So talk about this. You don't have to go into all the history of European winemaking, but just briefly summarize this and why grafting is important in this sense.
Well, yeah, he touches on grafting, and it was really a big deal because of something called phylloxera. And phylloxera is an aphid that came to Europe in the ambitious trade during the 1800s. This is a big deal, kind of middle 1800s. Phylloxera threatened the European grape industry, or France's grape industry. And this is when a lot of the varieties that they had did go extinct in France, but luckily some folks, you know, like Carmenere, you know, they were able to get to Argentina. And so you still have those varieties today because they weren't in France anymore. So they figured out, since the insect or the insect pest came from the New World, what if you could take the European grape, which is Vitis vinifera, and graft it onto the North American grape, which is Vitis riparia. And so this American, North American grape rootstock, so the part that's in the ground, was fused on to the high-value Vitis vinifera, you know, Cabernet or Merlot grapes that were up on the top. And so this literal Frankenfood, right? Now you've taken two species and glued part of one to part of the other. And it saved the wine industry in France. And nobody freaked out and nobody cares. And nobody cares that billion-dollar industry is using an untested, unproven technology that could have long-term effects. I mean, this is a real, out of all the genetic modifications that you can do, grafting has got to be the most radical and the most freaky, but somehow that one's okay.
Yeah. I wonder how many non-GMO project certified wines are grown from, grafted grapes.
All of them. Yeah, I think all of them. I mean, I don't know that production grapes, even in the States, are still on their own roots. I think you still have resistant rootstocks on most stuff. So yeah, it's or at least enhancing rootstocks on most grape varieties.
Yeah, there's a little all natural gardening store in I won't say what they're called, but they're like, their big thing is like, oh, all natural insecticides and all natural plants and blah, blah, blah. We bought a tree from them and the wind knocked it over like a month ago, but the tree started to regrow. So I called the store and I said, hey, can we just let this regrow? They're like, no, it's grafted, so you won't get the same qualities. So I just thought, I thought that was kind of funny. I'm like, well, you're selling grafted trees, but you won't sell me glyphosate. What's up with that?
Well, it was naturally grafted.
Naturally grafted by someone in Portland, Oregon. Okay. There was one other example from the story, Kevin. I was wondering if you could elaborate on. He writes that he's talking about late blight in potatoes and how devastating this was in Europe, and particularly in Ireland, because you had mass starvation and people leaving the country because they couldn't, there was no food. So he says, some of the potato's ancestor species in the Andes Mountains are resistant to late blight, but since potatoes rarely reproduce by flowers, it would be nearly impossible to move that resistance into modern potatoes through conventional breeding. So he's talking about using transgenics to bridge that gap. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, they've done this. It's great. So it's, again, it goes back to those disease resistance traits that specific gene variants confer resistance to the disease. And in late blight, you're able to do that as well by looking at some of these wild variants in types of potatoes, which were resistant to Phytophthora infestans. And the real good example, there's a couple of them. There's a couple of different species of potato that have these resistance genes. So one of them, Solanum bulbocastanum, and another one that eludes my brain right now. But there are two different, or at least two, that they've been able to take those variants from those potatoes and install them into conventional potato varieties, Burbank, russets, you know, Ranger, things like that, and now confer late blight resistance onto those potatoes. And that's huge because of the huge amount of fungicides that are used to control late blight. And now you've got plants that protect themselves. And if you want to do some fun Googling, you go into Google Images and look up late blight GMO, and you can see the difference of when that late blight resistance gene from a potato relative that you couldn't breed in was added through the laboratory. Pretty clear, pretty cool, good stuff.
I'm so encouraged because the tide is turning out. This is a theme we've hit a lot in the last couple of years, specifically on the show. But if you look at the UK right now, they split off from the European Union. There's legislation making its way through Parliament. I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's a bill that would basically deregulate gene-edited crops. So you have a lot of this research going on in the UK. We talked about the pro-vitamin D producing tomato a couple weeks back. You have all of these kind of projects going on over there. So that was for decades, the UK, Britain was a very serious anti-GMO stronghold. And now you have legislation making its way through. And once that happens, I think like culturally, the battle is over. You know, it's going to take time for the regulations to take effect. There's going to be a long political debate, but it's it's going that direction, which is really good. And then last week, China, their Ministry of Agriculture enacted some new regulations. They said, it's not totally deregulation necessarily like we have in the US, but they basically said, if it's a gene edited crop, if you're just shuffling existing genetic material around, we're not going to make you go through these really rigorous field trials the way we do for transgenic crops. So China's a massive country, right? So this is a big step in the right direction. The UK is, you know, a major developed nation. They're going in the right direction. Of course, you have the US and Canada, which are pretty good on these issues. So you have like in Argentina and Brazil, you have major food producers in major developed countries. They're sort of throwing off this anti-GMO stuff because it's run out of steam. I think that's just so encouraging.
Yeah, I agree. I think run out of steam is a good way to put it. And I think I was on an interview earlier today where we were discussing the same thing. And I think I came up with the idea of risk fatigue, that when you continually tell people over and over again, this is a problem, and the sky is falling, you know, and then here you are 30 years later and the sky didn't fall and mountains of technologies that could have been helpful are still sitting on the shelf. Maybe it's time to reevaluate the things you're grumpy about, because it's a unfortunate situation that even groups like Greenpeace and all Union of Concerned Scientists and all the other folks that have pushed back against biotech, they're wrong, and they've been wrong. And I would love for them to just come clean and say, guess what? We screwed up. Let's move on. Let's go forward. It'll never happen, but it sure would be nice if it did.
Absolutely. Well, we can only hope. I think, you know, the silver lining to what's going on now in the world with inflation and war and all this really devastating stuff is that the GMO catastrophe never came. But not only did it never come, the technology is now being implemented and it's making a noticeable difference. So this is just one recent example. In 2020, Calyx, they're a biotech company in Minnesota, they developed a gene-edited soy variety that has a healthier oil profile or fatty acid profile. And there was a serious soy shortage in the middle of the COVID pandemic. So they sold their entire crop that they grew that year to an agriculture processing company. So the U.S. food supply was just flooded with this gene edited soy. And no one noticed, because there's nothing to notice. It's just soy. It's healthier soy. You're welcome. But my point in bringing that up is, when catastrophes like this come, or there's a shock to the food supply, we have technology that is counteracting it to a certain extent. It's not a cure-all. It's not nothing like that. But it's very, in very practical ways, it's going to help feed people. And so I think this, to use your smoking analogy earlier, right? This is a coffin nail for the anti-GMO movement, because they're demonizing technology that is really noticeably helping a lot of people now.
Yeah. And I think COVID really exemplified that too. And when we're able to come up with a vaccine to defeat a virus that's made up from recombinant DNA technology, and when everybody's crazy aunt and barber is talking about PCR and mRNA, you know, I mean, this is what I've been waiting for, you know, as a molecular biologist, this is like just the best time to be alive. I finally have value.
They're talking about cycle threshold. They're doing it.
I know. It is kind of funny how everybody's an expert in the stuff I've been an expert in for a long time. And you know, now I got to start doing something else, I guess. But it is nice that we live in the best of times. And even though there's a lot of challenges going on, a lot of things, problems in the world, the fact that we have technology that can help us through it is something that's only going to continue to accelerate. And when we start to combine genetics with all the new stuff that's happening in big data and artificial intelligence and sensors and monitoring and drones and robots and all this stuff, I think the future looks pretty good.
Yeah, fingers crossed. But with that out of the way, Kevin, who are you following?
As it's been said, some people say that children are the future, but it's really robots. I don't remember.
You're going to have a really light workload in the future because the robots are going to do it for you.
Oh, damn right. I can't wait. No, I can't remember where that comes from. Anyway, but Yeah, who am I following? I'm following Emily Deans, MD. She's a evolutionary psychologist, actually, and usually has some pretty insightful discussions on her Twitter field or Twitter thread. So, you know, I appreciate what she brings to the table sometimes. So good stuff there. What about you?
I'm following a developmental biologist named Emma Hilton, and her handle is just @fondofbeetles, and that's beetles like the insect, not the band. And she does good work. She writes a lot about transgender people in athletics and a lot of the research around that. And I looked her up because one of my colleagues wrote an article about this and was criticized on Twitter for it. So I went and looked into some research, and I just to double check, you know, I'm like, this guy writes good stuff. I don't think he would have written this if it was unsubstantiated, but I landed on a lot of her work and her commentary, and it was just interesting. So go check out Emma Hilton @fondofbeetles on Twitter.
Oh, good. I'll check that out because I'm still sorting through those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I like people that say, this is what the evidence says. And if you don't like it, you can, go shout at a cloud. Okay. All right. Enough of all that foolishness. Thank you all for joining us so much. You can follow us as well @KevinFolta, @ACSH.org for my writing, my website, CameronJEnglish.net. Follow GLP. They're just @GeneticLiteracy. They put this whole show on. GeneticLiteracyProject.org is the website. And we will see you next week. Thank you so much.